the sentiments from Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, the 12th and 14th verses, take us into very important and somewhat familiar territory. He says, I am the preacher, and I've been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I've applied my mind, this is chapter 1, verse 13 of Ecclesiastes, I've applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the sons of men to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, vanity, all is vanity, and a striving after wind. The insight that the Bible unerringly offers is that the affairs of this world are a mammoth joke, and the things that we spend our lives seeking to gain possession of or experience are repetitive pathways that never achieve the grand hopes for love and success and undisappointed peacefulness that everybody wants. And that the great message of Ecclesiastes, that all is vanity, is a very true statement of the human condition. They asked a young Deniac this week at the Democratic Convention, I think she's about 20, and I mean, Howard Dean is great in an awful lot of ways, and she said that, why did you sell your bicycle or whatever it was to become a follower of Howard Dean? And she's young, and she said, well, I see that the same thing keeps happening over and over again. So I thought maybe in my life I could make a difference. Well, that was, she was quoting Ecclesiastes. I see that the same thing keeps happening over and over again. And that woman was really a very wise woman in her sort of hyped sentiment. It's an unhappy business because there's a, remember that song by Journey? You never can do better than Journey. I don't care who you are, you cannot do better than Journey. And their song, Steve Perry, The Wheel in the Sky Keeps on Turning. The Wheel in the Sky Keeps on Turning. It's not an Eastern insight. It's a powerful biblical insight as well. That the vanity of life is obvious. Mary and I have seen this of late and are packing up. It's very much, you know, we didn't pack, we went to Germany. We didn't go through anything because we were too rushed. And we didn't pack to go through anything when we came to Birmingham from England. And so we've got 20 years of things, of papers. And as you go through it, you get to the point when you decide to, well, what percentage do you think you end up throwing out? I even had to persuade one of my sons to keep his high school diploma because it just seems like vanity. It just seems like, you know, that was then, this is now. The things that matter to me enormously. Clippings about yourself, clipping, you know, all the different things you were into. It all is vanity. When you're involved in some kind of a transition, or anybody here cleaned out your mother's attic recently, or maybe your brother died, or usually it's your mom or your dad, or your aunt died, and you were called upon to basically clean house in 48 hours because the house is sold. And everything. Just a few bits and bobs of photographs and a paper or two, and certainly some furniture, but it's all gone. And that is the powerful truth of the life that Mary and I have just been rehearsing as we've gone back over our the last 20 years. And yet, there is this great exchange that comes into the human equation. Despite its empty pursuit of penultimate things, as if they were ultimate. Making good things into decisive things, or making stupid things into absolutely central things, there is a great transaction that occurs in life. And I'd like to call it the thing that many of you have experienced in the last 10 years, and possibly beforehand, and possibly it'll happen to you later, but there is something that happens to a person in light of Ecclesiastes that is very powerful and very enduring. And I'd like to call it the eschatological moment. Now, that's a big word that simply means the decisive moment, the thing that lasts, the aha moment, as we would say today, the eureka, the clarity on what you're dealing with here and what's you're facing in life. And the eschatological moment is the thing that so many of you, I think, from the letters and the emails and the many, many personal transactions that we've had in recent weeks, the eschatological moment is happening all over the church, and it's happened here. It happened to me, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that great eschatological moment that changes everything. In the story in the Gospel reading, which is Luke 12, the eschatological moment never happened to the man, except when it was too late. But it's happened to many of us, and it's very powerful to go back over this, the essence of what God has given us in an otherwise hopeless milieu known as the Veil of Tears. And a man is describing, Jesus is talking about a man, a rich man, who brought forth plentifully. And he thought to himself, Luke 12, 17, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said to himself, I will do this. I will pull down my barn and build a larger one, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, this is pre-retirement, early retirement words, soul, you have ample goods laid up for several years. Take your ease now, eat, drink, and be merry. That's where we get the phrase, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? Now, that is a picture of a man who didn't have the eschatological moment. And I'd like to speak about this, the great transaction of Christianity about which Jesus was speaking. The first part of it is when you come to the end of your ability or your aspiration to control your life. I've always said that I don't believe in free will, and it's one of the few sentences that I would never retract because it's so empirically obvious. Now, when I used to talk about free will, people used to think I was talking about predestination, and they leapt a bridge too far, although there is a relationship between the idea of predestination and the lack of free will that we have existentially. It's not the same thing. The first insight is the real insight. We do not have the will to freely change our circumstances at the point of impasse. That's all I'm saying. At the point of impasse, and it's a relationship, it's usually a difficult, quote, child, or it's an impossible person you have to live your life with, or it's a mother, or it's a dad, or it's a temperamental thing about yourself, or it's a cancer, or it's like Nemo, you know, he has a clipped fin. It's something that you have to live with, over which you do not have free will. And when the impasse is delineated, and when you are willing to agree that this impasse exists, the beginning of the great transaction, which is the essence of Christianity, happens. You are stranded at Ecclesiastes 1. You cannot, I mean, has anyone here in the last 10 years succeeded in changing your husband? Well, two hands went up in the back. But they're no longer married. No. actually, no hands went up, because you knew that I wouldn't have accepted it even if they'd gone up. Has anyone here actually finally cured your own particular persnickety daughter? You see, at the impasse, we are in preparatio. We are ready for that which God conveys to the human being. And that which God conveys is summed up in one word. The word is grace. Grace is one word which means unconditional favor or love. And it is to say that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were yet helpless, Christ gave his life for us. Romans 5. Now, you know, we don't believe that we do our little and then God does his bit. That's called semi-Pelagianism, and it's what many Christians believe. They believe, you know, if I do my bit, or if I have an intention, or if I just wait one step, then God will move the thing fully and do for me that which I cannot do for myself. That's not Bible religion. Our religion is to say that while we were yet helpless, Romans 5, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. And so the eschatological moment consists in an impasse that is fully experienced. And then it consists of hearing the preached, has to come from a sermon, has to come from some kind of oral communication. It doesn't come visually. It comes from oral communication. Some kind of a sermon. It can be of an ant, but it has to come from a word in the Bible. Thy word is truth. Where will we be without thy word? If I had not heard thy word, I would have perished. My tongue would have clung to the roof of my mouth had I not heard thy life-giving word. Read Psalm 119. I need a word, and the word says love. The word says grace to the sinner, not grace to the getting ready to unsin, but it is grace to the sinner, and that's the eschatological moment. And then you find that your perspective begins to change. You begin to see that what you thought was strength is really a bunch of hoo-ha, and that you begin to work from your weaknesses. It is your weaknesses where God always works, because he can never work if you don't need him. And why would he work? How could he work if you don't need him? He has to work where you need him. He works from your weaknesses. It's true in romantic love. I mean, what man here doesn't want to tell his wife what he really thinks about sex, usually that, or about, you know, what he's really thinking about his job, or his deepest feelings about his dad, or his, you know, sort of promised deeper side of life? What man here doesn't want to be known, although it's often very hard to get at him, what man here could not benefit from being known in his weakness? What woman here has not had to suppress her real thoughts out of fear that her husband or somebody would jump on her? The moment she said what she was really thinking, what woman here was not afraid to say to her husband or somebody, because he'd jump right over her, jump all over her, use it against her, try to fix it? So we don't work from our weaknesses. We work from our supposed strengths. But what person here hasn't had your love life not revolutionized when you were operating with at least one other human being, when you are operating from your weaknesses? Is there anyone here who could cite me an exception to that? And that's what the radical eschatological moment has done for you. You came to an impasse. God's grace was addressed to you in its Christocentric power. And then you began to see that which is weakness is the pathway to God's strength. And then you began, of course, to demythologize all your sort of prior things that you thought were so great. Somebody I know and love said to me recently that the biggest thing that happens in Christians as they go on is that they see that they've been turning unprofound things into profound things. You know, I said, what's an example? And she said, Bridget Jones' Diary, just like that. Turning unprofound things into profound things. You can give me some examples. I mean, sports are really wonderful. They're especially good for teenage boys. They're sort of life-meeting. And they can be wonderful for all sorts of growing experiences of father-son and team fellowship and forgiveness and aspiration. Sports can be wonderful But in Europe, they have been turned into something divine. And in Europe, something very good has been turned into an ultimate. The only time you'll ever get your head knocked off in England today is if you stand up for the wrong team in the World Cup. Now, they tell the Germans, the Germans can't feel because they're not allowed to feel after the Holocaust. It's very sad. The Germans are not allowed to really feel about anything. But the one thing I'm told they're allowed to feel about is soccer. Well, do you understand what a terrifying thing that would be? To turn something good into something ultimate? Well, this is the eschatological moment, and I believe it's happened with many of you. The correspondence of the impasse with the word of God's grace to sinners, not after you get out of the trouble, but when you're in the trouble as you find yourself. A turning of the perspective away from human strength to the power of working from your weaknesses, which is true strength. And then a perpetual unmasking of unprofound things that masquerade as profound. That is the eschatological moment. And I hope that it's happened for many of you. I came to you in my life having had eschatological moments. I had an eschatological moment when I was at Harvard Law School, and I fell flat on my face in such a way that it forced me fairly early to operate out of weakness. And then very early on in my ministry, I had an eschatological moment, and I fell flat on my face, 1,000 yards down, and had an eschatological moment of the grace of God in the impasse. And I did not bring to you here anything but that core message about the eschatological moment. Now, I'm going to finish by saying what I think my legacy is. Now, the word legacy gives me a total pain in the neck. So I hate the word legacy, so I have no legacy. That was a red herring. I can't stand it when people talk about what their legacy is, especially so-called public figures. I find it incredibly male, totally full of, what's the male hormone? Testosterone. I find anybody who talks about legacy is dealing with an over amount of testosterone. And because when you think, whatever you think your legacy is, nobody else does. You know any men who write their memoirs? I know men who write their memoirs, even people who aren't in the public eye. They write their memoirs. I'll say, that's a very important project you're working on, centralizing all that interesting information about yourself, Mr. So-and-so. And I'll say, I'm curious, for whom are you writing this? And he will always say, the answer always is, my children. I have yet to meet a child who has the slightest interest in reading his father's memoirs. As a matter of fact, they run away from it because it represents all this sort of, my dad thought he was such and such and he did such and such and I had to always be against him and da 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 da. The last person who's interested in your legacy is the people you think are interested. So let's just put the word legacy on the testosterone side of life. What is it that one might leave? And let me just say this. I've just been at a church. I was dedicating a building with Bishop Salmon yesterday, a big new church at my former parish in South Carolina. And this parish where I served 3.5 years, it's booming. It's just thriving. It's a person's most incredible dream to see it happening long after you left. And it's going in the right direction, as I see it at least. But another church that we served that we thought was the acme of our entire ministry went completely and totally down the tubes, humanly speaking at least. Now, these years in Birmingham have been the happiest 10 years of Mary's and my entire ministry. These have been the happiest years, and I can say that to you with utter look you in the eye. These have been the happiest years of our 32 years of ministry. They have been years of being received at the deepest level. And I thank you for giving us the 10 happiest unconditionally so, years of our ministry thus far. Thank you. And if there were a kind of way of putting that into words, I would say, if the word legacy, maybe it has a feminine meaning, I don't know, but if the word legacy has any value, I would like to read to you a verse from 1 Thessalonians. This is a very, very early in the writing of the New Testament. St. Paul wrote it in the very earliest time of his ministry and his great, powerful work. And he wrote this of the congregation whom he had served in Thessalonica. And this is the word that I would wish to give to all of you in light of the eschatological moment, which will endure. You see, whatever happens with the Church of the Advent, and I look for great things and I pray for great things, what's happened with you before God will not be taken away from you. The insight that you have received about yourself and the grace of God is enduring. And I know it because I'm still talking to people on the phone every day who we worked with 25 years ago, who will say the same thing, whether they live in Hong Kong or Grand Rapids. They would still say that the eschatological moment of the impasse, in light of the grace of God, in view of the weakness of man and the strength of God and the demythologizing of this world, which has led to works of love and freedom and joy way and above their wildest imaginations, I would say that that will endure no matter what the future may hold after today. And thus it is that St. Paul wrote in 1 Thessalonians, "I've endeavored to see you again, face to face," he writes, "because I've wanted to come back to you, I, Paul, again and again, but I have been hindered by Satan. For what is my hope or joy or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus at his coming? Is it not you? For you are our glory and our hope."